Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to Circumstance. I'm your host, Gina Cafasso. In this episode, drawing on serial killers, The Orange Rabbit, I continue my riveting conversation with Aaron Smith as we explore further what it was like to have Robert Gray Smith, the best-selling author behind gripping true crime tales like Zodiac and the Unabomber, as your dad. Join us as we explore how the unassuming orange Volkswagen Rabbit played a pivotal role in retracing the chilling steps of the Zodiac killer and a scary encounter with suspect Arthur Lee Allen. From anonymous phone calls to the letter sent to journalist Paul Avery, we unravel the threads that led to the creation of Zodiac, the groundbreaking book that forever changed the true crime genre. Tell me about your family dynamic growing up. You mentioned that your parents got divorced. They lived in two different places. Your dad was almost more of that, The weekend dad?
Yeah.
Give me a little background on that.
Well, shared custody, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, some homes the kids will spend part of the year at one and then the other. We were just weekends. We saw them weekends. It was, it may even have only supposed to have been every other weekend, but it feels like it was every weekend we went. Typically it was, we'd get out of school or whatever, and then we'd race over to the city and find him and then, race off to a movie and all that, like I talked about. It was always the first thing. Even to this day, if I'm in town, it's like, we used to start looking at movie times, like right away.
Oh, wow.
What are we going to go see? I think the reason I'm able to remember a lot of this stuff is there were changes that happened to me at kind of very regular intervals at that time where it's like, oh, my world flipped, And it wasn't always bad, but like, I can remember us looking at houses. I must have been like 2.5 or something to go to Berkeley. And I didn't know what Berkeley was at the time or anything, but, and then eventually we bought a house. But I have memories of seeing some of the houses before that. Okay. And we moved to Berkeley, and I don't know how long after it was, but they split and he got this other place. So, and then that was memorable, so it kind of locks these things in. And, what year I might call that is off, but that's where, when I go back and look at these things, I'm like, oh, that was clearly this year or that year or this, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Helps pin down other memories, because I know they took place in a certain time period. But, I know we were talking about trauma and stuff like that before, and it's like, I hate to say I'm traumatized or something, it's not that kind of thing, but clearly everybody has something. There's a way you react. And I do remember them, arguing, and if I tell you right now, yeah, I'm not traumatized. But then as I describe things, I will tell you, like, oh, yeah, I don't talk about my dad in front of my mom. I'm 53 now. It doesn't happen. And I don't, occasionally I'll talk about my mom in front of my dad, but I usually don't do that either. It just is something, it's a way I've, I it was probably the very first place where I sort of split my life, and even now I wear a lot of hats and I'm very good at separating that. And it's not like I have all these different faces, but it just, I can compartmentalize when I need to,
Interesting.
For the most part.
Do you feel like his obsession, like you said, or focus on the Zodiac had anything to do with them splitting? Or
I think it freed up his focus. It gave him the time. It's like, you know, he was working when he moved to the city, he was living closer to work. So he'd have his 8-hour day, and then there were no kids or wife to come home to, so he could do that stuff. Although I don't know if he really delved into the case at that point, or if it wasn't until like 75 or 76, you know.
So they got divorced prior to him really jumping in then, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. He may have been obsessed with it at the point, but I don't think he actually actively started working on a book until I think he was talking with Paul Avery. It was the Robert Downey Jr. character in the movie. And I remember him telling me about going to visit Avery. He kept going to Avery and asking him, when are you going to write your book? And at this point, Avery had already gotten that letter from Zodiac, and everybody was wearing these little pins that said, I'm not Avery, because he basically had a threat from the Zodiac. And so they would wear these, you know, buttons.
Oh, wow.
I'm not Avery. I'm not Paul Avery.
So what was in the letter? Do you know?
I forget exactly what's not one. I can kind of picture. I have to go back. I'm going to blend them together if I'm not careful. So I'm not going to quote it or anything.
But it was a threatening letter, in other words, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if you got a letter from the Zodiac, and you knew it was the Zodiac.
It wouldn't be like, happy birthday. Love the Zodiac. Yeah,
it'd be like, don't look at me. I don't exist, you know?
Yeah, right.
So
face on it. Yeah, that's no. Yeah. The style.
And I don't know how much that led to his downfall in the end, if he was freaked out by it or whatever. But I know, I would think it would have been after that somewhere that, you know, dad was pestering him about the book and said, when are you going to write your book? He's really excited just to be, I think, in the proximity of it. And Paul snapped back. He's like, I'm not going to write a book. You want to write a book? You go write a book.
Oh, wow.
And I think that may have planted the seed. I'm not totally sure if he'd already been thinking about it or not, mm-hmm. you know, but he... But I think that was a big eye opening, like, you know, getting permission to do that. So.
Oh, really? So he kind of felt like he needed that, do you think?
I don't know. Maybe it was just one of those, like, you know, when you look at somebody that you think is larger than you, larger than life than you, you know, we've all done this. You go to school, you get a new job. I remember working when I went to Sony, there was some guy that started the week before me. And 2 years later, I still thought of him as being ahead of me, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's weird. Like, I knew I was doing much better work than he was at that point, but still it was like, I don't know, somehow that relationship. So I think it was helpful to have somebody go, you can do this. You know, I mean, I don't think that was the exact message, but that's right. What came across. So I think that's around the time, and that may have been like 75, 76. I feel like everything he got that VW Rabbit, that was a big turning point for us. Cause we could leave the city now. We weren't limited to mm-hmm. where the bus or the train or BART train went. So we'd find ourselves down in Santa Cruz and, you know, up in Vallejo and wherever else, you know.
So what year did he finish the book, and how long did it take to publish it once he did finish it?
Well, so he started at the Chronicle in 1968. And then he was there for like 15 years to the day. So he left in 83, right around the time that he had sold his book. And he was so excited. He was like, this is great. See you later, suckers. But he had the book and he didn't realize, like, oh, no. Just getting your book deal. That's not the end of it. There's a long period. So it was about a 3-year window after that where he had to wait for the book to come out, you know, but continue to work on it and research it. And so I think that was really difficult, a really difficult time for him. Lean times, probably, I'd say. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
Now, did he receive any threats from anyone? Like when he was writing the book or anything, did he get any... letters or, well, we talked about the phone calls, I think, before, like you said, you didn't pick up the phone, but that he did get some phone calls.
Yeah. So I don't know if he got any direct threats. He, you know, he's talked about phone calls and things. I remember him getting phone calls, but I never answered the phone. I never heard the nothing on the other line or the breathing, but I know they happened. And I do remember him talking about them regularly back then. And that would have been, I think that would have to be 1980 and on. Cause I think, so I believe the first time I went to Vallejo was in 80. We may have done it before, but I'm taking that from actually reading the book. When I was reading the book, I went, oh, that was May of 80. Okay. In my head, I think it's like 1978 or something, but it must have been later.
Well, tell me about the first time too you read the book, because you mentioned something like you were babysitting and you happened to just like, oh, okay, I'm going to finally read this book. So what was her initial impression when you first read it? Like, what were your thoughts?
So I guess it would have been 86. I had the hardbound copy. And for some reason, I thought it came out earlier in the year. Maybe I just had a copy for a while or whatever. But I know I was staying at my cousin's house, and she was supposed to babysit some kids. And then something came up and she couldn't. And then my aunt said, well, you go do it. So I took care of these kids for the night. But I put them to bed at, 8:30 or 9, whatever it was. And then I just laid down on the carpet in their living room, and I was reading the book. And I may have already been reading it, but I remember being there and reading the part where it's nighttime and he's driven up to Vallejo and he's waiting for Alan to come out of the hardware store. So we can just, what does this guy do at night? Where does he go? What else does he have other vehicles? Does he have stuff hidden somewhere? Like what, is he watching somebody else? And so he parked out in front of the store, and I was so disappointed this wasn't in the movie. I was waiting for it, but he realizes, oh, the lights in the store go out. Alan comes out, and so he scooches down in his seat in the car. And as he's waiting there, he realizes, I don't know what he's driving. That's half the reason that he's up there. He wants to see what Alan's driving. So he's like, well, he's waiting a minute. He's about to scooch up. And I think I could be misremembering this, but I believe it was that the headlights in the car behind him came on. I don't know if that's correct. That's the way I've always remembered it being told. I may have embellished in my head somehow. but he was sitting there, and he realizes, oh, shit. And then this car pulls out alongside him and stops. And I don't know how much he can see and how much is him sensing it, but he had at the very least gotten the sense that the driver was leaning over and trying to look into his car. He could see. He knew somebody was there.
I just got chills up and down my spine. I'm just telling you, but go ahead.
But okay. I think that was the first time I realized at any point that, like, that whole fly on the wall thing doesn't exist. like something really bad could have happened right then. And Alan drives off, and I came all the way up here. So he follows him. And I'm assuming Vallejo's pretty quiet at that time. Maybe not a lot of cars. So I don't know if you could really hide very well if you're tailing somebody. I think he stayed about a block behind him. And Alan turns down some street. And so he follows me, turns down that street. He sees Alan park ahead. So he parks. Alan gets out of the car. So he gets out of the car. Alan starts walking. So I think he's staying about a block away. Alan walks a little bit further, gets into their car, and drives off. And he races back to his car. But by that time, it's too late. He's gone. But that was one of the things about Alan. They always suspect that he had many cars available to him.
Oh, wow.
And he had at one time worked at I don't know if he was working as a mechanic, but at like an auto repair place that was only open during the week. And I think at the time he wasn't working there anymore, but he seemed to have, theory has it at least, I should say, that he may have had access to the cars that were there. So it's possible that he would go in, somebody's dropped their car off on a Friday, it's going to be there all weekend, no one's working on it. You take that car out if it's working, So you could go commit a crime in somebody else's car. I don't know if that's what happened, but I know that was one of the theories that, there's a lot of ways that he may have had other vehicles available to him. So, and I know that was always a big part of why we were going up there, is we were looking to see what cars are parked in the driveway. Do you see a mobile home? Do you see this or that? So it was just kind of gathering information that way to find out. You didn't have the internet. You didn't have all these databases.
Right, right.
You kind of had to go do it.
So what was the public's response to the book? Was it well-received? Was it like people were afraid to read it? Nowadays, murder seems to be like, everyone's watching all these murder shows on television, all these like novels that come out, all these things. People go crazy over this right now. What was it like back then?
I know the book company didn't know what they had at the time. And it came out and it went on the bestseller list, but they hadn't printed enough copies. And they actually called him. They were asking him do you have any more author copies that we can send out to,
Wow.
They didn't expect it. And I know his editor wrote, he's like, I didn't see that coming. He's like, we did a good book, but I think when you're in that industry, you're putting a lot of stuff out and you just don't know what's going to catch. Doesn't mean it's good or bad. It just means that
it definitely would pique their interest to know, like, okay, what is this about? And let's see what he knows about this. Like, especially there's so many sleuths out there even back then, but I feel like it's definitely something that would be different. At that time, probably not as many stories about stories like that, coming up at that time.
I think there were stories. I mean, there's a lot of things that were going on up there.
There's a lot of things that happened. Yeah. in that area.
But there's always something to draw your attention. And, you know, there've been the zebra killings and there are a bunch of things that had happened. I think not just at that time, but throughout that time, you know, Zodiac was 68 and I don't know if they had, I want to say after 75 was maybe the last character.
But isn't he the most elusive? Like they call it like the Holy Grail of serial killers, so to speak. I hate to use that term, but that's what I've heard.
I think it's a little bit like the Thin Man. You've pumped this person up. I do think he's a horrible serial killer, but he may have only had 5 attacks, you know, like, you know, he claims this much larger number, but really that may be part of him toying with the police and taking credits. Like, to throw you off my track, I'm going to say I also attacked Kathleen Johns. Like, they don't know if that's actually one of his or not. It's always been on this sort of writing this line. And in the end, Fincher moved away from that, from the movie, because of that, you know, he tried to only focus on stuff that was where they had a witness to things. But Zodiac may have been going through and reading stuff in papers and in some cases, obscure papers, but taking credit for them, usually at a greater distance, but just to confuse things. And who knows, there may be other things that we don't relate to him that he did. So it's mm-hmm. it's unclear. But I think a lot of that stuff, you know, I mean, really the big time for it was probably at 69 there was where I think it was probably really, really blown out. But I think he was inflated a bit. It's like I was mentioning the I don't know if you've ever seen The Third Man, the Orson Welles movie. But Orson Welles, he's only on screen for like 10 minutes in the whole film, I think. But he's the title character. They talk about him for the first half of the movie. So by the time he comes on screen, you just see the silhouette of him. And then he steps into the light. And everybody cheers. You know, it's like, he's like, I get to be the star. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't do any heavy lifting in that movie, you know?
Right.
And I think there's a little bit of that with that, because these cases, because of when they happened, and the way that they were covered in the media and things like that, become larger than life as well, you know?
Because the book didn't come out until many years later, like after the last killing, so to speak, but yeah.
Well, it came out in 86. So, I think for the most part, I don't think the case was really being talked about much anymore. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really I don't think it was being heavily investigated, if at all. I'm sure it was still on people's books, but it came out, and I think, especially in the Bay Area, because it made such an impact at the time that, yeah, everybody's, oh God, I remember that, because it affected everybody. You know, when that happened, he threatened to shoot a school bus or shoot the tire out of the school bus, I should say, and then shoot the kids as they come bouncing off.
Oh gosh.
That was, you know, David Fincher had been in school at the time. He was hugely influenced like that. I think my brother, we were living in the South Bay, I think we would have been down there then. It was actually before I was born. May have been when they were in Stockton. But I know the buses there, they would have a either guard on the bus or somebody following closely behind. But those are things like, you know, years from now, we'll all talk about, well, where were you when you had to stay at home, you know, COVID? And there are all these shared experiences with large groups of people. Mm-hmm. I think there was sort of a collective memory of that happening and like an, oh, yeah. And I think on the book's part, I think the book is really well put together. I think even to the point where maybe the author and the editor weren't really clear why it was successful. But, you know, my feeling on it was always because there's the three suspects that are presented in it. And each one of them is a good suspect. But the first two, you're like, oh, my God, as you're reading the clues and you're reading the story and you're getting that feeling of getting closer. This is the guy. This is the guy. This is the guy. And then something doesn't fit. It's not the guy, you know. And then the next one, same thing. I think originally he wanted to put 5 main suspects in there.
How many suspects were there? Do you know?
Thousands.
Thousands. Yeah. Like at that time too. Okay.
You know, I mean, at least there would be lists, because there would be the people that are actual suspects. They're like, well, this guy's a criminal who can't be accounted for, and blah, blah, blah. And then there'd be people just turning people in, you know, or like I said, that there's just that. It's like a denial of service attack. The number of people that come in that want to be helpful or want to be at the center of it, you know.
Interesting.
Well, I know ultimately, earlier we were talking about Tosca and everything. When my dad had come around to Alan as the suspect, well, this sounds like the guy, you know. And when he came back to Tosca with that, he says, "I think I've got the guy here for you." They talked about it. I'm going to mess this up a little bit. But he came to Dave and he said, "Did any of your suspects ever write you did they ever contact you afterwards? He says, funny you should say that. I just got this letter from the suspect. And he's like, Arthur Lee Allen. And Dave's jaw dropped.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And he had a letter. I think Alan had just gotten out of jail and had written him, I'm sorry, I wasn't your man. That was the main
thing. Oh, God.
But that ended up kind of drawing attention back to him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That day, so
what happened after that? Like after he got that letter, did they try to go after him again? Were they looking at him again? Or?
Oh, yeah. I think once Dad was on to him, he was very focused with that. I don't know how much Dave was active, because he'd be carrying a full caseload at the same time, you know. So one of the things with the, you know, each of the police departments, they weren't talking with each other. So, you know, they were supposed to be working together, but they all had, you know, they all wanted to get credit for collaring the guy.
Oh, got it.
And I think what a lot of the detectives were finding was that, well, you know, Graysmith, they could sort of use him as a shuttle for information back and forth. We can find out what SFPD has, and they can find out what we have, and so on. And, I don't know if it was intended to be a two-way street, but kind of worked that way. So, you know, I think he was doing a lot of footwork during that. I think eventually when the book came out, I don't know how active any of those guys still were at that point with the case, you know.
Interesting.
You still have to deal with all your everyday crime, you know. So, yes,
which is, unfortunately, that doesn't stop when you're dealing with this. Yeah. That's unfortunate.
The problem is you have this high profile case, and it just, the public's aware of it, and it's frightening, and it's, but at the same time, there's plenty of other bad stuff happening.
And the movie didn't release till 2007, right? So that was even
right.
Almost.
And the prep for that. So he first met Brad and Jamie. The
and
movie.
Explain Autopilot. Who they are, Brad and Jamie. Who are they?
So in 2002, the first movie made one of his books, The Murder of Bob Crane, which became the movie Autofocus. Came out. He had come down here. I don't remember going to like a premiere kind of thing for it, but I feel like that's what he would have come down here for. But he came down. I remember him doing a signing over at, I think it was Borders on Westwood Boulevard. And he was signing some stuff or whatever. And I think some other people from the movie were signing stuff. And these two guys walked up, and it was Brad and Jamie. Brad is the producer. He was Mike Medavoy's protege. Jamie Vanderbilt, who wrote the screenplay, the two of them came up and approached him about optioning the book, and he just liked them from the start, and was like, yeah, we'll go with you guys. Then, so that was 2002. The movie came out in 2007, so there was a long, long road. I'm not sure if I sent you Shooting Zodiac or not, but that kind of is probably the last thing that he'll write about the Zodiac case, but it's really more about that experience. There's there's some detective stuff that goes on in there and stuff, but it's really about them, their perseverance to go through, like, we're trying to get this movie made. So it's a little odd. It's sort of true crime, but really it's behind the scenes of what's going on and how dedicated they were to, like, look, we're going to make this movie right, or we're not going to do it at all. And, they were really adamant to get David Fincher on it, especially once they found out that he had a personal connection to that.
What is his personal connection to it?
Well, it was just he was living in the area at the time. He remembers, being a kid on the school bus and, like, what I still got to go to school if this is going on.
Oh, wow.
So
Jake Gyllenhaal plays your dad too. So what was that like for you seeing it actually, because you lived it, now you're seeing it played out by actors. What was that like for you? Like, how did that, I mean, did you have, I don't know, was it just like, this is what's happening?
Or I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of movies and I'm working in Hollywood. So it's kind of what it is.
Like, eh.
I think Jake Gyllenhaal, I don't know if I was sold on him yet as a good actor. I've seen him do some good stuff. I don't know if he's who I would have picked, but he did an all right job. For some reason, I think I'd always pictured Kevin Kline just because I always thought he kind of looked like my dad, but he'd be too old at that point probably to play him. But regardless, I think the thing with the movie that was interesting was first off, getting to the end where he goes to the hardware store and then the movie ends. And I'm like, we're 3 hours in here or whatever. And I like, but for us, so many of my memories were us going there. And I wanted to see him following him at night and stuff. So that was a little bit like, oh, but really, I think he picked a good place to end the movie because it is about finding closure where there's no closure. When you get to that, being able to look at the guy and look him in the face and go, that's the guy,
yeah,
I can stop. I've done a good job here or whatever. And ultimately, with the book, it was about getting the word out. The movie itself, for how much stuff they had to cover, watching it was weird. It felt like a series of cameos because I was aware of all these people, but you're like, oh, there's Sergeant Mullinex. Oh, here's Detective, Toski's through the whole movie, but they felt like little walk-ons. There'd be a scene, they'd have a character in it. You wouldn't see the character again. It was a lot of that. It just is. There were so many things they had to check off in there. I think they did a great job of still keeping it fluid. And, but that was my takeaway was how you had to, so I don't think I can ever experience the way somebody else is watching that.
Right. Right. Well, how did your dad react to it? What was his response to it? Did he have a similar response to you or was he like, okay, this is good. I'm done.
He's always said good things about it. He liked it. He especially liked the Charles Fleischer scene. I think he really enjoyed the experience of, he doesn't work with other people. Even in the newspaper, you're working in this big building with all these other people. He was still kind of a little island doing his own thing. So with this, I think he had a good time being a part of that and being able to discuss stuff and go through it. I'm sure there was probably some difficulty to it too. And like I said, I was out of the country when he was actually in town. So lucky for him, he could stay at my house then. So I had a house sitter and he had a place to stay. But, I didn't get to see a lot of the inside stuff on that. And then I'm sure when I was in town, when he was, I was probably busy working on, Shark Tale or something. So
yeah, such a great movie though. Getting back to the movie though, like how accurate portrayal did you think that the actors played of the real people? Were they more caricatures of these people or were they similar to their personalities and did they pull that off?
I think they did a pretty good job. I know they tried when they could, they would try to go meet the people that existed. I know Mark Ruffalo went and spent time with Dave Toski and tried to do what he could, but it's still ultimately it's Mark Ruffalo playing that role or Jake Gyllenhaal. I think the one thing in there that really stood out to me is, oh, you nailed that. There's a scene later in the movie where he's now divorced again from my stepmom and he's in the apartment and there's all these boxes and he's got a cup of coffee and he's looking for some piece of evidence. And oh, yeah, that's it. That's the 1980 apartment there. Maybe it takes place a little bit earlier in that timeline in the story, but that was very that, just so obsessed and caught up and being in the middle of that. And, I'm sure us coming over to see him on the weekends was a little bit of a little disruptive as well. But in those early 80s, especially once he had left the Chronicle, so probably have to be like 83, 84, 85, he was just typing all the time and working. And we'd come over and it'd be a lot of like, oh, why don't you and your sister run out to go we go do something, he'd just be banging away and maybe interviewing people and stuff.
Well, tell me about his process too. So when he gets a topic or a story that he wants to tell, whether, and most of his stuff is based on either true crime or like historic, correct? I mean, is that kind of what he focuses on?
Yeah. Primarily? Well, so we've been working together a bit more directly. I've always gone through and like, listen to what he's doing. Listen, you know, he'd read bits over the thing. And typically when he has like a kind of a completed-ish manuscript, like I'm reading them, even if he was working with another publisher, you're like, oh, you know, this kind of be interesting if he did this or that. But since COVID, we teamed up, we realized at one point, we have a list of about 34 to 40 books that are in different stages. Many of them are complete books already. But just haven't been, you know, they need another pass or they just, for whatever reason, he just never showed them. So during COVID, we started going through and we realized at the rate you're going, neither of us will be alive by the time all these are out. So we kind of hunkered down and been going through and editing them and trying to give them feedback. And that's been a whole nother process.
So dive into that a little bit. What's the process like? I mean, I have to say too, it's tough working with family in general. So sometimes. So.
Yeah. I don't know if I've worked with any other family directly, but like, you know, like I said, he's not used to working with other people. I don't want to say he's not a good collaborator, but when it comes down to really doing this stuff, it's a little tricky, you know? Mm-hmm. So giving him feedback, I know back when he was working on the original Zodiac and then the Sleeping Lady and the Bob Crane book, he'd send his draft off and months later he'd get it back and they'd have crossed out one word. He'd like, you know, he's gritting his teeth and like, change that. Those are my words, you know? And so that was, at least I had seen that. I kind of was a little bit aware of that he wasn't necessarily going to take feedback very well. And that older process too, it wasn't like you were on the phone and the editor's walking you through his changes. And maybe you could have done that. I don't know. But you'd just get this thing and there'd be pages crossed out or, you know, words or paragraphs or whatever. It just like, and not necessarily, it may not be clear why that was crossed out. So I know like when I'm going through stuff, I go to great lengths to like document what I'm doing for myself. And then I don't necessarily send him, oh, here's a little key of everything I did. But usually I'll take everything, I've made those changes, I'll go through and I'll color code stuff and I send it back to him in like a PDF. And that way I know the pages are static. The text is not going to reflow in any way. I can always go to page 12, you know, but we'll go through and I go, look at this part that I have that's highlighted blue or this part that's yellow or whatever. Each one means something different. And I can walk through and go, oh, well, this part, I had a question here. What if we took this and we moved it later? I feel like you're getting this a little early or something. And even just the way I said that there, I try not to make suggestions. I try to say, you know, do you think that this might make a question out of it or what you have here that's working really well? So I find those are really helpful things. Like here's, it seems like what you're trying to do here is this, is underline this. I feel like this other thing gets in the way. So I don't say cut it, but I am thinking like if you lost this, it would be a loss, but right now it's a speed bump. It's getting in the way of what you're trying to tell me. So often stuff will get shuffled somewhere else or, you know, and a lot of these things too, he's working on these for so long. And as he's doing his self-editing, he's copying and pasting and moving things about. You'll end up with something in like a couple of places. And the opposite can happen where something disappears and it wasn't intentional. So a lot of times, because I've read multiple drafts, I go, hey, you had this thing and the other thing, that's not in there. And you go back and make sure it's in there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's kind of helpful in that, but it doesn't mean reading the book and hearing about the book a lot. And it's so funny. I can hear myself saying the book because I'm thinking of generic book because there's a lot of them, but he's always talking about like, oh, if you ever do an interview, you always mention the book. This is Graveyard Harbor. So make sure you run out and buy Graveyard Harbor, you know. And he says it makes him crazy when he's seeing somebody on a talk show or something. And they say, so go get the book, you know.
Yeah. You're like, what book? Great... Especially with him, he has multiple books. So, hey, that would not be so clear. It's true. Yeah. So, is Graveyard Harbor the most recent book that's come out? Is that the one?
Graveyard Harbor we put out in mid-October. And it's another, we refer to these at least internally as historicals, you know, they're
what does that
true
mean?
Crime, but there's so much history involved. It's a historical book, but it's a crime book and it's not necessarily a mystery. What's that?
Or is it kind of a mystery or not really a mystery? Well, so it's not a mystery, but it is, but it isn't.
I don't know if it's, in some cases, these are mysteries. There may be like, you know, who started the fire or whatever, but really, you know, we just liked historical and at least it's, we don't necessarily promote stuff that way, but it was an interesting, you know, it is true and it's crime and it's true crime. But when you think of true crime, you're usually thinking of, you know, contemporary, maybe starting in the 60s, you know. And, you know, he's got some, actually, The Laughing Gorilla. Sorry, I was going to call it The Gorilla Man, but I think that's the foreign name for it. The Laughing Gorilla is one that takes place in San Francisco in the, I think, 30s and 40s. And that one's definitely a mystery. You don't know who's doing these killings, you know. And actually,
so I don't know. You got to tell me a little bit about this story, because I know nothing about this story. All right.
It's a little bit of an amalgamation of a few things. But there was a guy that was checking into a place. He would check into a hotel, and they would, you know, later they would basically find a body stuffed under the bed. That book itself, I think it has sort of is this one case that spans a long period of time. So a lot of the book has their other cases that are happening in between as well. There's one where I think it was the DA or the assistant DA of San Francisco had kind of trying to remember exactly what his connection was to her, but he was friendly with this older woman. He ended up getting her to put him in her will.
Oh, wow.
He murdered her, but she was killed in a hit and run. But eventually when they figured out what had happened is that she'd actually been run over in her own garage. And then dropped the body in the street. So that's why you couldn't find the car that hit her. Yeah. That one, I don't have the great details for it. So, but that's an interesting one. And I know that was well received in Europe and in France and stuff. So some of them, you know, one of the many hats I'm wearing is learning how to read contracts. So
that's fun.
The first part of that it was very specific. We want to get the rights back to something. How do you do it? And every contract would and should have a reversion clause in there. So rights reversion. And there's usually very particular things spelled out as to when you can do it and what steps you have to take to officially do it. So if we were just to call them and say, hey, I want my rights back, like they could laugh at us and go, oh, sure, whatever.
Yeah, right.
But if we don't follow the actual steps, we can't. So usually it's like you have to send a letter saying, hey, you don't actually ask for your rights back. You say, I can't seem to find a copy of my book. I suspect it may be out of print. I'm hereby requesting you do another printing of the book. And they have depending on the contract, they'll have a window of time, might be 4 months or 6 months or, God forbid, like a year or something. But you have to send them this first letter, has to go to a specific address, and you need to kind of do certain things to make sure you've got a receipt for that and all these things. Mm-hmm. And then you usually don't hear anything back. And then you wait for that window of time, and you send another letter saying, as per my letter on this date, I'm hereby formally asking for my rights back. And so I've kind of gone through and I've set up letters for each of those, and each contract is different. So you have to go through and find the specifics.
Oh, gosh.
So that's been helpful. In some cases, it's better for him to like, hey, that book's still selling. That's great. You know, there's no reason you should try to take those rights back, because they're going to have a better distribution than you could do on this back end way.
Now, is the Zodiac still selling? Is it still selling pretty good numbers? Really?
Yeah. I don't even know what printing it's in now. It was, I think, at like its 43rd printing, the paperback, the yellow cover.
Right.
And then the movie came out. So it had already done kind of gangbusters by that point. And then the movie came out, they did a movie tie-in edition. So the cover changed and it became first printing again.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And then they did that for a long time. And if you've seen the movie, at the very end of the movie, George Bauert is at the airport. They've found Mike Mugell. He's going to interview him. And Mike Mugell, that's the guy that shot me, you know?
Yeah, right.
But they're in the airport and there's a rack of books in the airport and it's full of the yellow covered Zodiac that, you know, because this would have been 87 or later that's supposed to take place. So it's like, you have it on screen there. Why would you change the cover?
Right.
But that's part of how, you know, a lot of times with the contracts and things, like a movie tie-in edition means somebody else may get a slice of the pie because they're effectively kind of promoting it. And that's why there's a different cover. And so maybe it's going to sell better because it has a different cover. But in this case, I don't know if that, I wouldn't say that helped. It just created another edition.
Right.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for episode 4 in the series, Drawing on Serial Killers, coming soon. Thank you for listening to the Circumstance Podcast. I hope you will continue this journey with me as I explore various life circumstances to help inform, inspire, and educate. To hear more episodes, subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram. See you next time on Circumstance.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.